coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
I'm ready. You're on one tonight. This is going to be interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. We are excited to be here tonight. We ended the last show pretty dark, Cole.
We did. It was on such a down note that I feel like, you know, it's important to take a page from classic drama, almost in a Shakespearean way, where we're not so much following tragedy with a little sprinkling of comedy, but we are kind of lightening the mood today.
You mean like Better Off Dead? You mean classic drama, right? Or
oh yeah,
you John Cusack, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. The kid on the slopes.
That's what I was just thinking.
His newspaper money, you know. That is the stuff of, Library of Congress kind of.
But that went into space on the golden record.
That's right.
Carl Sagan.
650!
Excuse me. Yeah, so we finished our story arc. We talked about, I posted on Instagram, it was actually pretty funny. I'm like, we ended the last arc pretty dark, so this time we're talking about world-ending apocalypse! Yay!
That's right!
Yay!
No,
we love to get into comics, and we love it when comics surprise us, or shock us, or piss us off, or that's the whole reason that we have been doing this show for 258 issues. Good Lord, that's a lot of issues, Cole. And a couple times now we've done a version of this, or this is a reoccurring show. So what are we doing here?
Well, we're coming back to a topic that 9 months ago we explored. I mean, in a way, this topic, you can say, well, you know, you've done this a lot all the damn time.
This is all you do.
Yeah, but we did a targeted issue where we explored and examined the times when a comic book story went beyond the trappings of the staple-bound cover, that transcended being a comic book and elevated themselves into the level of literature which so many have. And sometimes it's just this one little piece of an otherwise anywhere from just a really good to an amazingly great story.
Right.
That then goes beyond. You have to put the thing down for a minute and really take stock.
It changes the relationship between you and what you're reading. Some instances it can remove you from the experience of reading a comic and take you to a place where it's like a really good movie, or
yes,
where you're no longer watching a movie. You know, 2 hours go by or 2.5 hours go by and the credits roll and you look around and you remember where you are. Comic books have that power, and they've had that power. We've talked about, I think in the last one we talked about Swamp Thing. And, you know, of course, I believe we talked about Watchmen, but when don't we? And when don't we talk about Swamp Thing, for that matter? But
Alan Moore is going to get his due one way or the other. It's just a given.
And matter of fact, he does tonight as well, just later. And so these are those a visceral emotional response, I think, is the best way I can put it.
That and then those moments when you just say somebody got it right. You know, somebody has taken an old chestnut or given you yet again the kind of things you come to expect in a comic, but they bring this extra element that is completely unexpected.
Right, right.
And those are the same sort of idea in a different angle moments when. And so, that's what we're here to talk about now.
Why don't you go ahead and just get us started with like the first one you have?
Absolutely. There's it's funny, when you talk about the body of work of one Frank Miller.
By Daredevil, the way, I think happy birthday, Frank Miller. No, it was we just celebrated the anniversary of his beginning run on Bullseye. I forget what anniversary, what do you get Frank Miller? How many ninja stars is 25 years? I don't know, but...
Yeah, just keep throwing until they all hit.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, quite all right. But, you know, there are certain titles that spring to mind when you mention Frank Miller. Sin City, 300, Dark Knight Returns, and Daredevil are among the top ones that just jump out at people.
Sure.
Almost to the exclusion of a Dark Horse imprint comic.
Uh-oh.
From a great, great many years ago. I was going to actually try to see if I could glean that really quickly, but this was back in 1990, I believe. And it's one of the more bizarre titles you're going to find because it kind of ironically, I hate to wind up going back into dystopian future because we're trying to escape that. But Give Me Liberty.
Oh, yes.
One of the real forgotten gems in the catalog of Frank Miller.
You're right.
And Give Me Liberty takes place in a very dystopian America. One of the things I love, if you get the collected edition, there's a map of the United States and Mexico as it's broken down into the territories that in which the story takes place.
Yeah.
There's like a great big circle in the Midwest that is apparently like this nuclear fallout zone from some atomic war. And then it is surrounded by all these other, you know, gigantic masses of land that have very large expanses between the lines of demarcation, except a good portion. I think it's probably like New York and New Jersey is one independent state, and Florida is another. And I love the fact, as a Texan, that in so many post-apocalyptic maps, and I think this was true of that god-awful show. What was that one where, like, all the electronics went out?
Revolution?
Yes, if you had a little necklace, it would somehow restart a...
You had a Wi-Fi necklace?
Yeah, it would somehow restart a smartphone that had lain dormant for 15 years.
Well, of course. It's the magic of TV, Cole.
Yes, indeed.
I gave up on that show at some point, long after that.
We were just like maybe an episode and a half in before it was like, okay, we're done. But one of the things that I loved was that if you saw any maps, there, like one of the big contending lands was Texas. But I'm getting away from that, but I just love the fact that somehow Texas becomes this place that just remains unaltered.
It's just border. Texas, right? Nobody messes yeah. with don't
no
mess
one,
with Texas.
No one to alter the borders. But the thing about it is, Give Me Liberty could be such a depressing story, but it isn't.
That's awesome.
Because there are so many points where the character gets a chance to kind of rise above and be better in spite of everything.
Yeah. I forgot that book existed, to be completely honest. Like
Washington is the name, I believe. And it's replete with the bizarre. But, you know, like grocery stores with this giant produce where the, you know, the commercial, the announcer is wearing a Dr. No radiation suit and carrying a Geiger counter. But there's just so many neat things that are done with this. But it takes the character of Martha Washington through this long and painful journey of literally making it, just edging by and constantly being, you know, passed over, abused, utilized for the machinations of others. And part of the storyline culminates in a plot to kill the president of the United States.
Okay.
And this is, of course, years before the, what was the one with, like designated survivor.
Yes, yes.
Because like the Secretary of Agriculture winds up becoming the ad hoc president.
It's always the Secretary of Agriculture, man.
Yeah, just. And, of course, he's completely inept and is in way over his head and completely, you know, just becomes an alcoholic and an angry alcoholic at that. And, it, you know, he's just sort of set up as this kind of background military coup is going on and is ultimately killed very Julius Caesar style.
Oh, no.
But cabinet and this military commander who'd Martha Washington had served under. And ultimately, you know, throughout all of this, she manages to rescue the preserved brain of the president they tried to kill.
What?
Foul the plot of her former commander and pretty much destroy all of her enemies. And at the very end, he is ultimately captured. She will not kill him. So that he, you know, stands trial and is imprisoned. And there's this wonderful scene at the end where she comes to talk to him and confront him. And during the conversation, and this wonderful art by Dave Gibbons of Watchmen, where she basically convinces him he's better off just to hang himself in his cell.
Jeez.
And she's taking her own belt off from her uniform for him to hang himself with, and one of the very last things is him looking at her in tears and saying, don't go, I don't want to be alone when I do it.
Wow.
Sits down on the bunk next to him and says, yes, sir, and then the very last panel is this very satisfied look as she's sees his body hanging there in front of her.
Man.
And yeah, that's just, I mean, I'm starting on kind of a downer note because there's some higher notes coming, but that is certainly, I mean, just, it's chilling to go back and look at that again.
Right.
And
right.
Be reminded of how abrupt and how that just, and in a way that, that kind of gallows satisfaction.
Yeah.
Of her finally succeeding.
That's crazy. I need to read. It's been so long since I've read that I need to get in there and read that again. It's been way too long.
Yeah, there were. It spawned a couple of sequels that unfortunately weren't near as good.
Right.
They're every bit as quirky and full of just the bizarre. But, I mean, Miller never again touched the level of just. And Dave Gibbons, you couldn't ask for a better illustrator because he captures so many, so much humanity.
Yeah. Oh man, that's deep.
Yeah, little pretty strong meat there to start us out.
Yeah. So I went all modern, which is weird for me, which is weird for us, but I went all a little more modern on my picks this time. I'm trying to challenge myself. It's very easy for me to fall back into talking about the Invisibles or talking about Animal Man or talking about, you know, it was Grant Morrison's birthday. So I really toyed with the idea of talking about Grant Morrison more, or talking about old, you know, old Black Panther comics or whatever. Like I could do that all day. So
yeah,
I've been reading, you know, a lot of newer comics, not brand new, but newer. I guess one of them is brand new. I went out of my way to anger myself with a new comic, but newer, we'll call them newer comics. Okay. And I just want to, the one I really want to talk about crept up on me. Okay. And that's why I wanted to talk about it. So recently Marvel had another Secret War, which sucks. Okay, so that's established as a baseline. Before that, Jonathan Hickman, and this is, I think, the that moment win for me in this is the moment that I realized that Jonathan Hickman is probably one of the most genius storytellers in modern comics, period. And I knew from his work on Captain America that he was brilliant. Like, he wrote...
I'm taking it he didn't have anything to do with that whole... Fail Hydra thing.
No, but I kind of want to talk about that on the next one, because it actually ended out up a lot cooler than anybody gave it. Everybody had a knee-jerk reaction to that, and I think if they would have just waited and read it, they would have been like, oh, I see what you're doing. Okay. That was Nick Spencer, who wrote the Sinister Foes of Spider-Man book that I keep trying to get you to read,
because
it's friggin' hilarious. No, so this is going to take a while. I'm going on a journey with you on this, okay? So
saddle up.
Yep. So Jonathan Hickman was involved in writing the New Avengers and the Avengers. And he wrote them for a good long time. He introduced all kinds of new and interesting concepts into the world of Marvel, such as the Neeli, which, do you remember the Marvel legend with the big gold Marvel legend with the weird horny head alien dude?
Oh, they're like X Nilo or Nilo.
Yeah. That is his race.
Yeah.
So the
oh, okay.
So throughout this period, the Avengers are interacting with his race and him, and they're the life givers. Their goal is to breed and give life to planets. And then there's this whole thing, and I'm shortcutting this part, but there's this. There's a whole thing with Avengers World, which was something that was created, the Avengers machine, that would allow for a continually, basically evolving team of Avengers to handle any threat. So, all of the Avengers worldwide with a machine that calls Tony Stark and Cap develop a machine that'll call the best Avengers for that, for that particular challenge. So, intermixed with this, we've got the Illuminati, consisting of Doctor Strange, Black Panther, and I know I'm going, I promise I'm going somewhere, Doctor Strange, Black Panther, Tony Stark, who else was in there? Oh, crap on a crap cracker. Black Bolt, Mr. Fantastic, Namor.
Oh, yes, okay, I remember
Beast,
that.
And Captain America was in there at this point, but, and I'm not going to get too deep into this. But the idea of these books leading up to a point where he starts writing a book called Time Runs Out, okay? So the last year of his run on the Avengers is called Time Runs Out. Time Runs Out, the catalyst for Time Runs Out is Black Panther is in a particular place in a particular time where he sees another Earth in the sky that then explodes, and he doesn't know why. So they start – he calls his secret society of smarties up, and they start trying to figure it out. What they figure out is that there's something called incursions happening. Incursions are when two Earths in the multiverse come into the same space and only one survives. So they're setting this up for Secret War, where they're trying to wipe, the Secret War was the reboot, was the hit the restart button. For Marvel. So they're trying to get rid of and smash in Crisis on Infinite Earth style, all of these worlds into one, right? The Ultimates world and this world and this world. We get Spider-Man Noir and we get all this weird stuff in one world now. But they start witnessing this happen. So what's really cool to watch is we want to protect our Earth. What are we willing to do to protect it? Every time another one of these Earths show up, what can we do? So they start developing missiles. They start, and do they have the guts to pull the trigger? At one point, they try to use the Infinity Gauntlet, and Cap uses the Infinity Gauntlet, can't control the power, and destroys all of the Infinity Gems, and it wipes his memory out. They take his memory away. So the rest of this is Cap getting the memory back of this happening, and then doggedly hunting down the Illuminati while they're trying to stop these incursions and just mad dogging these guys, right? Like, he doesn't care that the world's going to end as long as he catches these guys. Like, that's it. So, it's a cat and mouse chase at that point. But the real crux of how it gets cool is what are we willing to do to protect? What was the real human emotion and interaction that has to take place for us to destroy a whole nother populated Earth to protect ours? What are we willing to do? Well, in the end up, they're taking forever, Reed and Panther and they are taking forever to figure this out. Well, The flip side to this is the Cabal. And the Cabal is the... And the Cabal's been around for a long time, too. The Cabal is the mirror world version, Earth version of the Illuminati. So it's a Black Swan, which is a character that I really hope we get an action figure for, but she's a member of an alien race tied to this whole event, okay? She was sort of the harbinger of all of this. She comes and says, this is what's happening, and kind of triggers everything. But the Black Swan, Thanos, I think Doom is involved. Like, it's all of the it's all of the big swinging baddies.
Yeah.
Decide, you know, okay, so we have a vested interest on this Earth. We are going to handle this. And they handle it in the most horrifying way possible, which is to go to those Earths and just destroy the Earths. Like, they just go out there. You guys are taking too long. We're going to handle this. We're going out to these Earths and just ripping them apart. So that's happening while they're trying to figure it out. And they're getting hunted by Cap and S.H.I.E.L.D. and kind of the S.H.I.E.L.D. Avengers, which is like your Carol Danvers and your War Machines, your military-based Avengers. Well, the Illuminati have scattered into the four winds, except for a few of them that have stuck together to try to figure this out. Nobody's seen Doctor Strange in 4 years or 5 years.
Yeah.
He's just gone. There's three races of aliens, and this is where it gets cool. There's three races of aliens that they have figured out are in some way, shape, or form tied to these events, these incursion events. One of them are the map makers. They go in and if they know an Earth's going to die, they go in and strip it for its natural resources. They're robots.
Okay.
Okay, they strip it. They're very logical, very clinical. The other one is, what were they called? there's the map makers, there was the builders, and the builders are the Neeli and the Nilo. Okay, so that's another race that they're trying to build the Earth up. And then there was the Black Priests and the Ivory Kings. That's right. And nobody screws with them. Nobody screws with them. Because this is all being caused by a guy named Rabum Alal. So in the midst of all this, it's hard to explain, but in the midst of all this, they send like five or six Avengers into the multiverse to try to figure out what's going on and stop it on a one-way ticket, suicide mission. They find the Black Kings, or the Black Priests, and they find this guy. This guy turns out to be Doctor Strange. And basically, Doctor Strange is like, whoa, 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 wait a second. I'm picking planets that aren't inhabited. I'm picking these planets from the multiverse that aren't inhabited because if one has to go, I'm going to make sure it's the right one. Well, at this point, they're starting to get there and starting to find a solution. Then lo and behold, the Beyonders show up. Because it's leading up to the Secret Wars.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So all of a sudden it made sense. I didn't even put two and two together until the Beyonders showed up that's what was happening. That they were, you know, that this was all a giant experiment by the Beyonders to, you know, to see how everything would react. But the reason I picked it for that moment when was the interactions between the Illuminati trying to figure out the best course of action for keeping their Earth and their population intact while sacrificing another population was heartbreaking. It was absolutely heartbreaking because you have Reed who's trying to come up with the numbers to support his theories and you have Beast who's like, don't even question what I would do to protect my population of mutants. You've seen it. Like, we have learned, you have forced us to survive. So we have learned to survive. You know, we'll do whatever it takes. You know, and it's just a really interesting. Plus, it also put me on notice that Jonathan Hickman was just a long game stellar writer that I had never seen coming. So I just wanted to bring that one up.
No, in fact, it's those long game stories that are often the most satisfying because the best ones you don't see it coming.
Right. And you didn't. I didn't. There were so many instances in this book, and it's a lot, right? It's a lot of issues. It's at least 12 for Time Runs Out, plus all the stuff before that that he's been setting up Time Runs Out. So all of these jerkheads out there, all of these, they're like, you know, they don't know what they're doing when they plot this stuff out. Really? Because this is like 3 years in the creation to get to this point. And it's amazing. I can't suggest it more. I know this isn't suggested reading, but I'm going to give you the moment when it did it for me, right? It was the moment that Namor flipped from the Illuminati to the Cabal, to the bad guys, right?
Yeah.
Because that was the only option to save his people because of all the hand-wringing that was happening on the other side.
He sort of forced into a situation that
there was a nobleness to it, and there was, you know, an anger. It's that same Namor, but I think it's the most beautiful representation of Namor that I've ever read, where there's a nobility and an anger and sort of just a resignation that this is what has to happen. So yes. Read it. That's all I'm going to say. Beautiful. It was great. They did a great job. And you think I spoiled it? I spoiled nothing. This thing goes on and twists and turns and bends. It's great. Okay, that's what I got.
That's absolutely. That sounds amazing.
It was good. It was good. I never thought the lead up to Secret Wars would be good.
Is it downhill after that? Or
Of course it's bad. It is. It's real bad after that.
Well, you know, speaking of long game authors, one of my favorite to invoke on this show is, of course, James Robinson's Starman.
Yes.
The thing was purpose built to tell a single story, but trick you into thinking it was just an ongoing series like anything else on the market at that time. And one of those moments in a series chock-a-block full of them.
Right.
Is that Jack Knight, who's the son of Ted Knight, not of Mary Tyler Moore, who's the new Starman, the heir apparent to the mantle, who is begrudgingly taken over the role after the death of his brother, the other heir apparent. But, there's a great... so many places it ties into the golden age of DC characters and, you know, his lineage. And one of the things is that Jack doesn't want to wear the superhero costume. He's more, you know, wears his favorite leather jacket with a antique kids 10 star from some radio show and just whatever hip street clothes he's got.
Right.
And so he's gone out and he's fighting crime in his typical attire, including a T-shirt that features the likeness of the character, the old Golden Age villain Ragdoll.
Oh, really?
And Ragdoll is one of those characters you think, wow, that's a criminal that's going to strike fear in your hearts.
Until you learn about Ragdoll.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Which you... in turn do after he's beaten back some bad guys and served some justice, cold or hot, I'm not sure which, but he goes back to visit his dad at this observatory where he is continuing his studies. And one of the neat things about this series is a bargain is struck between father and son. You know, his dad very much wants him to take up the mantle of Starman and use this cosmic power rod and, you know, keep the family business going, as it were. And Jack finally concedes on the basically sort of on the strength of, if I do this for you, you have to do something for me. And that is to turn your incredible scientific mind away from superhero gadgetry and start doing something worthwhile for mankind. You've got a brain the size of a planet. Make some use of it. And so, you know, he comes in there and as is often the case in the series, he comes to visit Dad, and they're having a conversation, and it ultimately leads to this T-shirt where he's wearing the likeness of Ragdoll, and he's ask him, you don't think that, you may think it's kind of hip and cool, and that it's a lot of people might recognize that this is Ragdoll and not like Raggedy Ann or Wizard of Oz Scarecrow or something, and that there was a very tragic chapter in the history of the Justice Society where Ragdoll led some violent it's sort of borders on the Manson family violence, this reign of terror and violence that is perpetuated. And so you have this moment where the kind of generation gap and the perceptions they have, like, you know, kids wearing Che Guevara T-shirts.
Yes, yes.
Who have no clue what that's emblematic of.
Sure, yeah.
And I think that did a wonderful job of addressing that sort of thing within a fictional narrative. And then ultimately, I think it's much later, you get to delve a lot deeper into that reign of terror and how it was ultimately ended. And speaking of, what lengths do you go? And there's this suggestion that there's a bit of an ignoble secret past that's a constant theme in Starman of these glorious Golden Age heroes, that they weren't all as pure as you would imagine. And you do find out that, I don't remember if it's ever clearly defined, but a few members of the Justice Society kind of took it upon themselves to eliminate Ragdoll.
Yeah. It's
with impunity.
It's borderline Watchmen, borderline Infinity or Identity Crisis, like right at that kind of level of the things that you don't see. You get to see the documentary crew version when you read those comic books. Now we can tell you some of the stuff that happened off panel, and you brace yourself because it's going to be rough. That's a really cool one. I like that one. That's good. God, I need to read those, Cole. I still need to read all
of them.
I know. Are you ready for this one?
God, I hope so.
I don't think you are. Again, I kind of went a little off script for my that moment win. You know, so this last week, my personal that moment win, I decided that I'm going to walk away from DC for a while. And I want this to be a discussion, Cole, because I think that it needs to be, but I decided that I needed to spend some time apart from DC, which I feel like has been a long time coming for me with the modern era of DC. Like, I still love Vertigo, and I still read old DC, you know, your Batman, you know, I still we'll dig it to, you know, dig it to the center of the earth, but this Watchmen thing, man, it just did it for me, and I can't. So,
well, God bless you for that, because I couldn't even from the suggestion was too much.
Well, the epitomous, the, you know, death of the comedian in Watchmen for me was one of the upper echelon of comic book of that moment win for me. You know, when I'm talking about comics, cracking open Watchmen for the first time, regardless of what age you are, and it opening with essentially this guy, this superhero in big air quotes, right? Getting kicked out of a window, and so beautifully and masterfully written and illustrated that you never, and we touched on this last time, but, you know, it cuts away before he hits the ground, and then you're left with the button. Yeah. You're left with the button in the sewer sewer grate. I mean, it's Blade Runner quality symbolism.
Exactly.
I almost said, I almost quoted Boondock Saints and said Blade Runner quality symbology. symbolism. And for me, one of the moments that I realized that I loved comic books was this is where I was at.
Yes.
In recent years, DC has gone a long way to turning me off. Everything from New 52 and Flashpoint to Rebirth, to now the idea that their big push is to fold Watchmen into the standard DC universe. We've already seen a return of Ozymandias. We've seen Rorschach make an appearance. This last one, we saw the comedian reborn. And the idea is he never hits the ground outside. Dr. Manhattan bamfs him into the standard DC universe. And, you know, where am I? What happened? And that's where we find the comedian. To add the final, and I think what was the final nail in my coffin here?
I just want to point out very quickly.
Yes, please.
That I'm just all of a sudden hearing this song in my head about starting a joke.
Oh, that left the whole world laughing?
Or left the whole world crying.
Right.
Comic fandom crying.
But I guess that's a question that I have for you, but I wanted to... The final nail in the coffin, the one that finished for me, that I was like, I'm not going to read this. And I've read some crazy, batshit, crazy comic books, right? I've read some crossovers and some mega events that...
Oh, bear in mind, I choked down Brat Pack.
do I need to bring up Bloodlines? Or I've read them all.
I've read them all, baby.
I can't, because in the panel at which you see Dr. Manhattan's lanky blue legs standing behind the comedian as he tries to raise up from the beach that he just landed on, in front of his eyes, after all the events of Watchmen, there's the button on the beach, and I was like, that's it, and.
So did he, like, help him out with, like, his punched-up face or anything?
No.
Did he give him a tissue or...
Yeah, no. It's Dr. Manhattan. Of course he didn't. It's not so much the idea... And this is the conversation I want to ask a question.
Okay.
Are we too... I want to really look at this. Are we too reverent towards Watchmen? Is it as untouchable as we think it is, or are we self-aggrandizing, you know, a time period or a comic book that should be allowed, this should be allowed to happen during? You know, we don't talk about...
Yes.
We don't talk about Swamp Thing showing up in the pages of Justice League Dark the same way we talk about this, you know? Are we doing a disservice to the book, or does it need to be left alone, I guess, is my question for you.
I'm going to say that in this particular case, see, we can allow for Swamp Thing to appear, to become part of Justice League Dark, for the same reason we can allow Justice League Dark, but what I'm really getting at here, though, is that the... you know, Swamp Thing being in Justice League Dark is not an affront to the best Swamp Thing stories, the best Swamp Thing writers and artists ever, because there is a fluctuation of quality in every title. There are those arcs that just blow us away, then they'll, you know, rotate some hack in for the next 26 issues. Or, you know, things drop to a level of mediocrity, or you get Secret Wars. We have a reverence for Watchmen that is a due reverence, because Watchmen elevated the comic. Watchmen was purpose-built. It was intended to be a finite tale.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to try to force it into the greater DCU, to try to Crisis on Infinite Earths, it, you know, the part of the purpose of the Crisis was to bring the Charlton characters and the Fawcett characters and the various Earths that had been allowed to fester into the fold.
Right.
Watchmen was never part of or intended to be part of the DCU, especially given its origins as the entree of the Charlton characters into the DCU.
Valid.
Which
Valid
proved
point.
Unworkable, so it had to become something apart from. And, you know, you could argue, well, that it would be kind of like, at this point, why are we not bringing Sebastian Oh or what's her name from that Las Vegas comic? Or I mean, the list goes on and on. Why do we not have the Batman, the Blue, the Gray, and the Bat showing up?
Right.
Why? Because they're not high-profile, marketable things. Why, you know, why aren't the Paradox Press characters? Why aren't we getting the, what is it, History of Violence?
That would be awesome.
And fighting the comedian. The reason is we're not giving overdue reference. We're railing against one of the most blatant cash grabs that's out of the 1980s Marvel playbook.
Right.
And that's what bothers. It's when someone is better than that, that we cry foul.
Correct. I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
DC, I'm calling you out here, DC. You're better than that.
I'm disappointed.
You were better than that.
And I think that, I think I do. I think I need to walk away from DC for a while and let them work this out and figure out where it's going to go. I haven't been invested in DC since, I haven't read any of Rebirth whatsoever. I just couldn't. So that's where I am. And that was my moment when I gave up on DC for the time being. And that's it. That's all I got for that.
That's understandable. I mean, I will have to give you that because it is very well deserved. I've got a little brief moment when.
Okay.
Because it comes from one of my favorite, ironically, DC stories that, if I'm not mistaken, we.
If it didn't happen last week, you're safe.
Yes, absolutely. This happened back in the good old days. Actually, in a period where sometimes things were a little hit and miss. But probably one of the best Batman family stories ever told.
Okay.
Arkham Asylum, Living Hell. Dan Slott and Ryan Sook. Just insanely good story because it takes you inside the walls of Arkham in a way no one ever has. It ties in not only to the bizarre-ass nature of Batman's rogues gallery by even giving you some extra rogues that you've never seen before. Many of, for the sole purpose of being expendable rogues. You know, you're not allowed to kill Killer Croc or Penguin.
Sure.
God forbid Joker, at least until Kingdom Come. But you know, you do have the, if you create a new character like, you know, Lughead or Junkyard Dog, they all fit the mold brilliantly, but you've never seen them before. But there's that inference that they're like all of the Gotham villains. There's just, and they're in Arkham mixed in with all these other familiar characters like Killer Croc or Two-Face.
Sure. KG Yeast was in there.
But really is a foreign national. But anyway, one of the neat things is there's a couple of just brilliant concepts behind this one character who has his origins in Arkham Asylum, Living Hell. And you never, it's one of those things you probably figured you'd never see him again. And apparently they have continued to utilize this character of Humpty Dumpty.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of gives you a little bit of chills if you are familiar with this story, in that, you know, Humpty Dumpty's compulsion is to take things apart and put them back together again.
Right.
And ultimately that led to a lot of inadvertent accidental criminal activity. One of the things that's so cool is that Humpty Dumpty, you see the character you see the world through his eyes when he's recounting his tales. Like at one point he's been given a ventriloquist dummy to put back together again because it got trashed. So he's charged with repairing Scarface.
Yeah.
And but you get to see this very fanciful world that oftentimes, you know, in the backgrounds you'll I've probably talked about this before, where like people in the background as he's walking around Gotham, some of them look like storybook characters with the heads of wolves or chickens.
Oh, that's awesome.
Or like, you know, when he's going to bed at night, or, you know, going out at night to ply his newfound compulsion, you know, he's waving at this fanciful storybook crescent moon with little stars depending from it from strings. And that you see that his vision, the way he looks at the world, is through this lens of almost a kind of children's storybook.
Yeah.
But and then you find out that, you know, the real reason he wound up in Arkham is that he tried to take his grandmother apart and put her back together again.
Exactly. Damn.
But even with all of those amazing aspects of the character, one of the things that is the realization as you move through the narrative, because there are all these characters you're thinking, well, you know, these are all just a bunch of throwaway characters that you've never seen. Batman's never faced any of them. You're just told that Batman brought them in.
Right.
But all of the stories about Humpty Dumpty revolve around him being tracked down and ultimately incarcerated by Batgirl. And you have this sudden realization, that is brilliant. Why have we never seen Humpty Dumpty? Because Batgirl's adventures aren't nearly as well chronicled.
Right.
By making a major player in this tale a Batgirl villain, it does two amazing things, and that is explain away his importance. You know, explain how he can be so important to the tale, but we've never heard of him. It elevates him outside of that, you know, throwaway character arena. And at the same time, it gives Batgirl some history that she's never had.
You're allowed to build the backstory with a good character to work from and say this, again, this is what happens off panel.
Yeah.
You know?
So, you know, Batgirl gets a shot at being a major part of a story.
That's fantastic. I remember reading it, and then you told me about it again, like, a couple of years ago, and then I read it again, and then I forgot about it, and then you just told me again, and I'm like, shit, yeah. Because it's that they lull you into this false sense of security that he's sort of this not quite all there guy, almost savantian in his, you know, ability to, or his desire to fix things, that ended up on the wrong side of Batman and ended up, you know, behind bars. And, you know, I'm not going to say they're nice to him, but, you know, they go to him and to fix things, or he wants to fix things, and you get this idea. And then you realize, oh, no, he's Ed Gein. Like he wears a clown outfit and buries children under his front porch. That's who he is. Like, yeah, but it's good. You're right. That's awesome. Yeah, I need to read that again. I've got one more if you want it.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So you know, the now infamous and long-running feud between Fox and Marvel have caused the Fantastic Four not to have been published for a good long time now.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Marvel just started doing two-in-ones again, which is awesome. Ah. They're on number two, being helmed by one of my favorite writers in comics today, one Mr. Chip Zdarsky. I don't know if you're familiar with Chip Zdarsky, Cole, but...
I have a feeling I need to be.
Well, Chip Zdarsky wrote Sex, or I guess he co-created, I shouldn't say wrote, Fraction wrote it, but he co-created Sex Criminals, which we've talked about. He also wrote Howard the Duck, the new Howard the Duck, some Spider-Man, some Jughead. He's right up your alley. He's also Canadian, which is awesome. But when the role came up to do the Marvel 2-in-1s, he was tapped to do it. Here's where things get interesting. This is the moment when Chip Zdarsky, with the stroke of a pen, and I'm almost positive, unbeknownst to the Marvel editorial staff, if you listen to him talk, rewrote the Marvel timeline in a Marvel 2-in-1. God, I love this guy. I love this guy. He shows up to conventions in full Spider-Man onesies, like the tight suit Spider-Man onesies. Like the one that I have that's Green Lantern. He's just hilarious. He did those. Did you ever see the recent covers of the comics that were How to Draw X, Y, or Z?
No.
Oh,
I'm so out of the loop. It's sad, but I've done a barreling up on 300 issue comic show.
Well, no, these are variant covers, and I bet you've seen them, and you haven't even known you've seen them. You know the old classic How to Draw X?
Oh, yeah.
So he redid them in possibly the funniest way ever. Like, he did Spider-Man. You know how we were always making fun of the Spider-Man was the torture character for artists because of all the webs?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he makes fun of that. He makes fun of, like, all of the different things. It's awesome. Like,
it's like one time years ago, Frank Anderson was talking about how he wanted to do a thing where it showed if you took Snoopy from Peanuts and you erased his ears and his nose, you got bone.
Oh, yeah. You're not wrong.
Holy crap!
Hold on. I'm just going to send you this.
It's like the lazy man Snoopy. I never realized.
It's just the lazy man Snoopy. So he's writing these 2-in-1s. Hold on. I'm trying to get you this link. Just so I know this is bad form for podcasting, but suck it up. There, I sent it
this
over
is,
to
this
you.
This is what we call long form, bad form.
This is bad form podcasting. That's what we perform. So, yeah, it's hilarious. He's hilarious. So, he is writing this 2-in-1. 2-in-1 is the Thing and the Human Torch, okay? So, Marvel still uses the Thing and the Human Torch and Mr. Fantastic and Invisible Woman. They just don't put them into a Fantastic Four book, right? So,
yeah.
Marvel kind of bases their entire timeline of when the Fantastic Four became the Fantastic Four. That's what starts Marvel, okay? That's their set-out timeline. So, every once in a while, something happens that causes that timeline to shift, thus keeping everybody young. Like, nope, the Marvel Universe actually started in the 1990s, right?
Yeah.
Or the Marvel Universe started in X or Y or Z. Well, Zdarsky just kind of, I think that he went off the reservation a little bit and decided that Reed and Ben and Victor, because it shows them, right, in the comic, and then he's holding like a cup, like a Stanley Cup style trophy, right?
Yeah.
That says Victor Von Doom 1998, which would have meant that the three of them went to college in 1998, which means they wouldn't have gone even into space.
Okay, yeah.
Until 2005 to 2008, which resets the Marvel timeline from then to a post 9/11 timeline. And I'm pretty sure he did it just because it needed to be done.
Yes, indeed.
And
there used to be kind of a doctrine of occasionally resetting your timelines.
Right.
So that you could have explain away why no one ever ages, or.
And that's what this is, except he did it with, and usually those are met with some fanfare. Like the relaunching of Fantastic Four relaunches the Marvel Universe. So Fantastic Four number one, when it relaunched as a comic book, right? And I believe Hickman was involved in that, but it kind of reset the timeline. The suburban Fantastic Four runs, those things, that reset the timeline. Boom, you're restarting in like 93. That's when it starts. Big fanfare, number one, everybody restarts, heroes reborn type shit, right? This was just literally a plaque on a thing. Like, yep, there it is. We're done now. Everything's reset. How do you like them apples type of thing?
It's such a thought-provoking, and that's rather one of the reasons we're doing this particular concept, is that literally, you know, it makes you think. You sit down and you start to, like you were saying, you do the math, and all of a sudden, the entire Marvel Universe has been reset.
Yeah, it's just instant. Like, right there, done, reset. Why is Peter Parker 35, and he's been between the ages of 25 and 35 for 25 years? Oh, this
pretty
is
much
why.
Forever.
Boom.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty brilliant.
Me happy. I wanted to end on a happy note.
Absolutely. And I had something that I thought, well, that would be a bit of a downer to end on, so why don't I find something different? And I did. This is from the same title. It's much more uplifting. In fact, one of those moments when that I really wanted to talk about in a series full of moments when.
Oh.
And the topic of our next issue. So this is going to be a bit of a preview.
Transition.
Yes, for next week's saga, the Saga of Saga, where it's about damn time. We devote an issue to one of the most transformative books, in my opinion, because this is taking comics to new places in ways that were decidedly unexpected. And it appeals to me on so many levels, not the least of which is that you are just sort of thrown into the deep end of the pool, as it were.
Right.
Because you're thrust into this world that is just seriously effed up, shouldn't make sense, but is strangely approachable and almost makes sense. And that is, of course, you know, as I said, this is we're talking about Saga, Brian K. Vaughan, Fiona Staples.
So good.
Or depending on which edition of the collected you might grab, you find that Fiona Staples suddenly starts taking top billing, which is kind of bizarre because there's a couple of journalist characters, Upshur and
they're my favorite characters,
and Doff, yeah, who there's a great point where somebody, you know, recognizes, I think it's Prince Android or Prince Robot rather, it's like, oh, the infamous Doff and Upshur. And he's like, no, it's Upshur and Doff. The writer always gets the headline, top byline. And it's just kind of funny that Fiona Staples is now kind of headlining the whole thing. And rather appropriate, really, because she does such an amazing job of, well, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, next. Yeah, we've got a whole episode to talk about that.
We've got a whole episode to do that. But I want to talk about a moment when... So, you know, this is going to be a bit of a spoiler if you're unfamiliar. Go out there and get the 8 volumes of Saga.
Jeez. Yeah.
And keep, and you will binge it, and you will, I reread the entire thing in like 3 days, I think, because I could not put it down. But there's a wonderful character that one of the, there's this kind of murderous bounty hunter type character who, becomes something greater in that he goes to this, like, prostitution planet.
Damn it. God, I just read this last night.
And he rescues this little girl from slavery and prostitution, ultimately. And for a lot of the series, she's called simply Slave Girl until somebody admonishes her, you know, you really ought to give her a proper name. So he winds up naming her Sophie, and that has significance down the line. But there's this great one page, 5 panels that just are choke you up, because Sophie is lying kind of in the sleeping embrace of Lion Cat. She's sort of leaning up against Lion Cat as Lion Cat's there fast asleep. And she's kind of, you know, cocks her head and says, "My name is Sophie. I'm 6.5 years old. If I can stand on one leg for a really long time, my favorite color is blue-green. I want to be a doctor or a dancer when I am grown up." And there's just this wonderful sense of joy and embracing this unexpected freedom and life and possibilities. When she began, you know, having been sold into slavery, and then she into prostitution slavery, no less. And then she sort of looks off to the side and says, "I'm all dirty inside because of the bad things I did." And Lion Cat, who's been asleep this whole time, just kind of lifts her head up and goes, "Lying."
It's so good. Damn, it's so good.
Yeah, and then Sophie just, you know, puts her head against Lion Cat's back. And it's just, holy God, I need an injection of insulin. That is so sweet.
We need to do a whole show on just Lion Cat.
Oh, God.
I mean,
Lion Cat was in The Breakaways, which was, what, like 100-something issues ago.
Well, Lion Cat is one of the best comic book creations of all time, because it's telepathic Greek chorus. And I mean, what I mean by that is...
I like that.
Is he, the Lion Cat is telling you the truth. Nobody can lie to you when Lion Cat is around, you know, so he's breaking the fourth wall to you and saying, this is the truth, this is a lie, in a book that is so interwoven with truth and fiction.
Yes.
That you need that ferryman on the river Styx of honesty to get you to the other side of the shore.
As Sophie, and as she grows older, calls her Honest Cat.
Which is more accurate, right? Like,
absolutely. One of the other things that's so amazing is the effect to which Lion Cat is used throughout the series. It could be such a hackneyed and tiresome kind of character, but instead, there's just so many ways the character is utilized, and we'll talk about that in depth.
Yeah, we're not going to do that.
Because she's just one of the most amazing. Like you said, this is a character that really needs the consideration of being one of the best we'll ever know in comics.
Yeah, for sure. But that's a tale for another day. I think we've done justice to that moment when, and we now know what we're doing next week, and I could not be more excited for that at all, ever. So, Cole, why don't you plug us up, and we'll let these fine people get out of here.
Absolutely, and thank you for joining us. I hope that we kind of struck some chords with you with some familiar, if you're familiar with some of the comics and stories we talked about, or inspired you to check them out if you went ahead and decided, oh, spoilers are no big deal, I'll still enjoy it for what it is, because there's so much more than just those mere moments. Yes, indeed, we're coming to you from the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. You can check out our tweets at the Jedi Cole U, and was it Hey Kids Comics Show? Or
it's HK Comics Show, Instagram Comics and Twitter as well for that, too.
Absolutely. You can write to us. Please write to us at – no, actually, I haven't set that up yet. Never mind. Don't write to us there. But you can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com, or look for us on Facebook. And also look for me in the morning the first and third Sundays of every month on DallasOnAir.com over – at the Rancor Pit live from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. And on the third Sundays of every month, my new show, Isle of Toys, which will be in its seventh month.
That's incredible.
In February. So yeah, I'm not yet 100% which what kind of toys we'll be talking about, but we've had some amazing talking about Transformers, console video games, and vintage Star Wars, of course.
Of course.
I'm looking forward to where this is heading next. So be sure and check that out. And of course, first on these every month, the hour before the Ryan Corpette, Eddie Medina, and his wife Colleen have Figments.
So good.
So check out the Cryptid Couple if you can.
And shots across the bow again for Australia, you bunch of assholes. Forgetting those Infinity War Marvel Legends before anybody else.
And apparently the people in California getting all kinds of other Marvel Legends figures, like the Lizard line and the Sasquatch line.
And the second X-Men line, the Deadpool line that includes that LaFeld cable. And did you see that thing I sent you, by the way? You want to talk about that moment when on the way out? I sent you a news article that said that Rob Liefeld has been sitting on an Alan Moore script for like 20 years because it's too hard to draw. God damn it. Damn it, Rob Liefeld. You are the bane of my existence, and if I didn't love you so much,
apparently, part of the problem was that Moore, if you look at the body of Moore's writing, feet.
It's predominant.
Yes, a lot of just downright fetishism almost on the feet. And, you know, we know Liefeld and feet, they just...
Well, I mean, it's
Moore's
fault.
It's the old axiom over at Image: Rob Liefeld and people's feet, nary the twain shall meet. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's part of this blame is on Alan Moore for inventing that character in that book called 10-Foot Punch, who was a Calypso character that comprised solely of 10 feet, and that's just asking for trouble when you hand that over to Liefeld.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. I think that's enough. We're getting out of here. We'll talk to you next week. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody, and get out and read some comics.
That's right. Read Saga with us this week so we can talk about it next week. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.